This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. From the tariffs the U.S. government has placed on foreign goods, to the shuffle in the British government and the ongoing Brexit saga, to tensions between Japan and Korea, to anti-government protests in Hong Kong, it's been quite a summer of political unrest around the world. Lake Effect's foreign policy contributor Art Sear joins us now to help make sense of what's going on, and he begins by giving us a lesson in basic economics to explain what tariffs are and why governments impose them.
Tariffs are the most obvious and straightforward barrier that one nation puts on other nations in order to try to protect its domestic markets. We live in an increasingly global economy, which means that tariffs, in effect, mean less and less. Nations have lots of other ways to protect their markets in more subtle and harder to regulate ways, but much more important, especially large corporations, but not exclusively, the great big guys, are global manufacturers and are able to move product manufacturing as well as capital literally around the world in order to avoid tariffs. So in effect, tariffs mean less and less. They mean more and more for us because of two things. We have a president who I've read in serious media is seriously and personally committed to protectionism. He is a protectionist. But also Congress, starting with the early 60s, has delegated more and more authority to the president. Tariffs are a form of taxes, and constitutionally Congress is supposed to impose taxes. And my guess is Republicans especially will be more and more active in trying to bring that kind of authority back to the Congress, since the president is clearly committed endlessly to doing what he can to raise tariffs. I hope that's clear. It's, in some ways, it's not as complicated as it seems.
So when tariffs are imposed by this president or any other with the intention of protecting our own domestic markets, what is actually happening now? Because everything I've been reading has been saying it's not working, that who's really being hurt here are, say, Midwestern farmers, you know, the wheat growers, the soybean growers.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And so those are the folks who are actually getting the brunt of it and with something that's supposed to be helping them.
Yeah, well, they've never, modern farmers have never been in favor of protectionism. And historically, we have almost always been, certainly are today, the biggest agricultural exporter as well as importer in the world. And that's certainly true of a farm state like Wisconsin and others in this region. Our governors, including Governor Evers, they are unavoidably committed to not only trade delegations and trying to promote trade, but especially trying to promote our agricultural exports. So the farmers don't want these dislocating subsidies that the White House is trying to bestow upon them. What they want is continued free trade. Also, in today's modern economy where data collection is pervasive, you can target particular sectors, not just states, but particular sectors and particular industries. My understanding is that the Chinese have been targeting Jack Daniels, not just liquor and whiskey producers, but Jack Daniels because it's a Tennessee operation and Tennessee is a red state strongly for Trump in 2016. It becomes very, very sophisticated. So particular sectors, including but not just our friends in farming, pay a price for this. Since the Great Depression, the conventional wisdom for many years, and it's right, is that protectionism ultimately is self-defeating. That didn't used to be the case. Historically, a lot of economists as well as business people were committed to protectionism, but it just doesn't work and can be quite counterproductive, as the terrible experiences of between the two world wars demonstrated dramatically.
So we are in the middle of tariffs being imposed,
yes.
Sort of a trade war going on.
Oh, yes, indeed. Yeah.
And so what happens geopolitically when this happens, when the United States is so protectionist? Who's stepping in to fill those shoes, those global shoes?
Other nations are in terms of political leadership. I think one of the most perceptive and persuasive analysts of international affairs generally is Lawrence Friedman in Britain of King's College at the University of London. And he has been arguing quite persuasively in print that the longer this administration continues on their current course, the more other countries, including our British friends, look elsewhere for their partners and their leadership. I think protectionism does tend to isolate us politically. Obviously, I'm against it.
Well, even though the Cold War is technically over, you know, one of our, I won't say enemies, but certainly somebody that we watch out for is Russia. And it seems to me that Russia, this is a prime opportunity for them to step in to offer exports to China, to Iran, to other places that had been markets that we were in. I mean, is that fair? Is that true?
Yes.
Okay.
It's fair more in military security and political terms than economically. President Putin of Russia is, in my view, brilliant at playing an extremely weak hand economically. Russia is a very weak country, and if they didn't have petroleum plus other minerals, they'd be a basket case. And foreign investment has been leaving Russia as a result of Putin's increasingly autocratic ways domestically. But he's been quite brilliant at playing that weak economic hand very effectively politically. Russia has now replaced the U.S. as the principal power in the Middle East, a profoundly important development. At the end of the George H.W. Bush administration, the Cold War was over, and the U.S., thanks to the Gulf War and post-war diplomacy, we were dominant in the Middle East, an extraordinary opportunity which we have frittered away. The Russians have stabilized and provided security to Syria. The Russians now have an agreement with a traditional enemy, Turkey. The Russians now are getting along with a traditional enemy, Iran. President Putin and the Prime Minister of Israel have a practical working relationship, one of our strongest allies, at least that used to be. And the fact that President Trump has been simply giving the Israelis what they want essentially has furthered Putin's influence because he's disciplined, he's practical, he knows what he wants, and he's very good at getting it beyond rhetoric. So you're on to a very important point, but where the Russians are concerned, it's not primarily economics, in my opinion.
It sounds like what the Russians are, or at least Putin, is very good at doing is playing the long game.
Exactly. Very disciplined outlook, very important outlook, the kind of role that the British historically played very well for a couple hundred years when they ran the world, and we were natural successors, and at least now we have frittered that great advantage away, in my opinion.
You bring up Britain, and I was going to save them to the end, but since you've brought them up, okay, Boris Johnson, Brexit. I mean, it seems like they have gone from the, you know, running the world to being, in some cases, just the laughingstock. I mean, where are we with all of this?
Well, I used to get laughed at as a very young person. I was a graduate student working on my PhD dissertation in England on the Liberal Party, and our generous British friends were quite willing to spend time with me as the non-liberals would literally laugh and say, this young man is working on the liberals. They were the very small third party at the time. Of course, people aren't laughing anymore, except me. I've been vindicated because the Liberal Democrats are one of the several major players now in British politics. It's kind of sad in a way that they're tearing themselves apart politically, but they will survive. They have always, again, historically, throughout their history, they have felt separate from the continent. So in that sense, Brexit reflects their traditional ambiguity about the continent. Militarily, they remain firmly committed. They orchestrated the American and Canadian involvement with the NATO alliance. They not only orchestrated our crucial involvement during World War II, when stakes were at their very highest, but they helped keep us involved in alliance after the war, and that's remained continuous.
They're still very much involved with NATO.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they actually fulfill their commitments in terms of the amount of economic resources they devote. They're extremely good militarily. But keep in mind as well, and perhaps this is the most important point, the European Union was set up to promote economic intercourse, but for a wider purpose, to bluntly rein in the Germans and prevent a third terrible war in Europe. And it succeeded in that sense. I think the British economy, which remains the fourth or fifth largest in Europe and one of the most effective in the world, will continue to be important whether they leave or not. It's too bad, given the passions of their domestic politics, they can't be a little more orderly about this. But I do think it will provide an opportunity. If they do leave, I think they may well muddle through to stay. But if they do leave, I think it'll be an opportunity, as President Trump, in fairness, has pointed out, for closer relations with North America.
Well, that has been a special relationship.
Absolutely.
For a long time. So I would hope that that would continue whatever happens. My fear is that the internal chaos around this vote, whether they're going to leave, how they're going to leave, whether it'll be a hard Brexit, a softer Brexit, when it will happen, it's been moved so many times that, you know, there's a joke going around that I saw that in 2060, we'll be colonizing Mars, but Britain will still be trying to leave the EU. And I'm afraid that there's some truth there. And it seems like that the decision that finally gets made will not necessarily be the best one because it will be out of frustration and finally somebody just saying, okay, that's enough, we're doing this.
Yeah. They're one of the most stable countries in the world in terms of the rule of law and the kind of processes that we respect and increasingly characterize the world. That hasn't changed. We can also joke about mobs in the streets because there aren't any in Britain regarding Brexit. The disciplined two-party system has broken down. And we have today not only the traditional Labour and Conservative parties and now the Liberal Democrats, but also the Scottish National Party, the Welsh Nationalists, who've always been there rather quietly until lately, and, of course, the notorious Brexit Party, which Nigel Farage is a one-man band, essentially. And
a loud one, though.
Yes. His UK, and they get European representation, but they don't do well in Westminster. There remains an overall stability to the system.
And so to wrap up this month, Japan and Korea, what's happening there? Korea is a longtime ally of the United States.
Absolutely.
And Japan certainly has been since the Second World War.
Absolutely.
What's happening?
Well, their history is one of great tension. And the Japanese occupation of all of Korea from early in the 20th century and especially from 1910 was exceptionally brutal. People generally aware of the fact that Korean women were forced into terrible prostitution, especially to service the Japanese Imperial Army in the 30s and 40s until 1945. But that was the kind of the tip of what was a terrible repression in an effort to try to stamp out Korean culture and history, quite literally. And our Korean friends are understandably quite sensitive to that. Japan in 1965 paid the equivalent of about $500 million to South Korea as compensation for these war crimes. But they don't really acknowledge, the way the Germans have, their history publicly. And that vexes the Koreans. Douglas MacArthur never forced them to do what Dwight Eisenhower and John McCloy and Harry Truman and General Marshall forced the Germans to do. And that's part of the vexing current relationship. Japan, within the last few weeks, has removed South Korea from a special list of short list of countries that don't have to pay tariffs, that have very easy access to the Japanese market and vice versa. They've ended that special trading relationship. The Secretary of State Pompeo met early this month with his counterparts from South Korea and Japan to try to work things out. Trade tensions continue, though, and they may get worse. I think the best procedure and approach of the U.S. government is to reinforce our already strong security ties with South Korea and Japan and give more and more emphasis to trilateral planning and exercises. And North Korea makes that easy to do.
Lake Effect foreign policy contributor Art Sear is a professor of political economy and world business, and he directs the Clausen Center for World Business at Carthage College in Kenosha. You can listen to our past conversations with him at wuwm.com.